You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. On today's programme, an attempt to republish sections of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf in Germany is blocked by the Bavarian state. Why is this cranky, discredited book still perceived as dangerous? We'll find out why CEOs are making more and more than their workers and why it matters.
It's funny who we think it's bad to get paid a lot and who it's good to get paid a lot. So my favourite example is that Wayne Rooney earns much more than a CEO of a FTSE 100 company.
We'll be telling you how you can star in a Brazilian soap opera, and we'll get the latest from the Rotterdam Film Festival. All this, plus more, plus music, on tonight's instalment of Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, the latest world news with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The rich and powerful of the world were divided at their annual gathering in the Swiss town of Davos today over Barack Obama's threat to raise their taxes, with some saying policies that go after the wealthy will hurt growth, but others saying Obama was right to address capitalism's imbalances. Obama's State of the Union address focused on channeling middle-class anger at inequality, including a call for a 30% minimum tax on millionaires that could make the wealth of Republican rival Mitt Romney a central election issue. The president promised to oppose the politics that resulted in the global economic crisis.
Tonight, I want to speak about how we move forward and lay out a blueprint for an economy that's built to last. An economy built on American manufacturing, American energy, skills for American workers, and a renewal of American values.
Thousands of Swiss military and police have been using snow to build security barriers to prevent demonstrators from gatecrashing the World Economic Forum in Davos. Some 3,500 military personnel are on hand to provide security to the nearly 2,500 delegates. US special forces have swooped into Somalia and rescued an American and a Dane after a shootout with pirates holding them hostage in a rare raid into the Horn of Africa nation to free foreign captives. The aid workers, American Jessica Buchanan and Dane Paul Hagen-Tistel, were kidnapped from the town of Galkayo in the semi-autonomous Galmudug region in October while working for the Danish demining group. The Danish Refugee Council said Buchanan and Tistel were now at a safe location. Tens of thousands massed in Cairo's Tahrir Square and other Egyptian cities today, a year after an uprising erupted that toppled Hosni Mubarak, spurred on revolts across the region, and exposed rifts in the Arab world's most populous state. United last year by popular anger at Mubarak and his 30-year rule, Egyptians gathering on the January the 25th anniversary were high in spirits but divided between activists demanding a swift end to army rule and Islamists celebrating their dramatic change in fortunes after emerging victors in a parliamentary election. Presidential candidate Amr Moussa says he expects more changes in other Arab countries.
A change is the hope of all citizens. We cannot continue to live, and we should not live under dictatorial regimes or with the rule of oppression and telling the people what to do and how to feel.
A government bus driver sped through the streets of the Indian city of Pune today, smashing his empty bus into dozens of vehicles, killing 9 people and injuring 27. He just went berserk, the city police commissioner told reporters. Police were interrogating driver Santosh Mani to try to determine what sparked the deadly rampage and were likely to charge him with murder. Nordic budget carrier Norwegian Air Shuttle has placed an order for 222 narrow-body aircraft worth $21.5 billion at list prices to be split between Boeing and Airbus. While SAS struggles, Norwegian has thrived, lifting passenger numbers by 3 million in 2011 to 16 million. The Russian Central Election Commission has approved the candidacy of Russia's third richest man, Mikhail Prokhorov, and registered him as an official candidate in the March the 4th presidential election. Prokhorov is vying for his country's top office, reinventing himself as a politician with an obsession about Russia's future and a plan to put it on the right track. And finally, travellers hoping to glimpse the golden pagoda of Rangoon or hear the tinkly temple bells of Kipling's Road to Mandalay may soon be able to book into a Western or a Marriott thanks to Myanmar's re-emergence from political isolation. Starwood Hotels and Resorts and Marriott International both said during the World Economic Forum in Davos they wanted to start running hotels in Myanmar. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Nick. And now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Let's take a look at Europe, and some of us have been catching some incredible night displays of the Aurora Borealis unusually far south across the continent. Sadly, in London, it's been a little too cloudy because of weather fronts crossing far western Europe, and this pattern will continue. More cloud and rain from time to time, and mild across western Europe. Eastern Europe, on the other hand, currently a cold snap here, which will spread into central Europe by the end of the week. Sub-zero temperatures by day, even in Germany. Here's Thursday's city forecast. In Moscow, minus 10 degrees and sunny. This is by day. Oslo, minus 1, partly cloudy. Berlin, 0 Celsius and cloudy. And in London, 9 degrees with rain. How about North America? After a sunny Wednesday in New York City and most of the Atlantic seaboard and the Midwest, it's going to turn a little cloudier now and wetter. Currently, a rainstorm is brewing over Texas and will eventually reach Washington, D.C. and Long Island. So here's Thursday's city forecast. In Washington, D.C., 10 Celsius and rain. In Chicago, 2 degrees and sunny. Montreal, minus 7, partly cloudy. And in Los Angeles, a mini winter heat wave, 26 degrees with sunny skies and no changes over the next 5 days. Other world destinations, and let's take a look at the Asia-Pacific region. In Tokyo, next 2 or 3 days is looking fairly sunny, highs of around 6 to 8 degrees. In Shanghai, increasing clouds and rain, 7 Celsius here. In Hong Kong, mostly overcast and around 17 degrees. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Thomas. It's 18:07. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yokoso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, nearly 80 years after its publication and nearly 60 years after the defeat of the ideology it espoused, Adolf Hitler's memoir Mein Kampf remains a sensitive subject in Germany. Earlier this week, a magazine called Zeitungszeugen, whose publisher, Peter McGee, is British, announced plans to print sections of Hitler's manifesto, along with explanatory annotations. Following the threat of legal action from Bavaria's state finance ministry, which owns the copyright to Mein Kampf, Zeitungszeugen decided to blank out the offending passages. Earlier today, I spoke to Hans Christian Teubrich, director of the Nazi Party Documentation Center at the Museum of Nuremberg. I started by asking him why he thought Zeitungszeugen were proposing to publish the excerpts.
I see it a bit from the ironic side, because it is sort of irony that a British editor coming from a country who gave some 400 lives to fight down Hitler and his dictatorship, now coming to resell Hitler's Mein Kampf in Germany. Well, I think he's expecting sort of business, maybe. It's an idea to go onto the market. That's it.
What are the legalities of republishing Mein Kampf in Germany?
Well, at the moment speaking, there are no legalities, because the publishing rights are with the financial ministry in Bavaria as a successor of, well, certain rights deriving from the Third Reich. So, among others, from the Eher Verlag, the publisher of Mein Kampf in between 33 and 45. And as the law in Germany is, on the one hand, it is forbidden to distribute the author's rights. About 70 years will cease only through 2015. And before that, any distribution or selling of Hitler's Mein Kampf in Germany is forbidden. You may own it, you may read it, you may take it from other countries, and you may take it from a public library. That's not the problem. But to sell and to distribute is forbidden by law.
That's an interesting point. So the illegality occurs because at the moment it's a copyright issue. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
You need to have the permission of the Bavarian State Finance Ministry.
Correct, yes.
But in 2015, anybody will be able to publish it.
That's true, yes.
Why do you think there is still a certain squeamishness, I guess, about Hitler's words? Because Germany has, in many respects, done an absolutely exemplary job of facing up to its Nazi past. Why do Hitler's words still have the power to frighten?
Well, I don't think that this is a general view here in Germany. It is, of course, the point of view of the Bavarian Ministry of Finance. They have to take this point. It has its history, of course, because in the first years of Germany in the 1950s, 1960s, we are speaking of a continuity in the German society. I think many more right-wing people or even politicians were active in Germany, so that it was quite all right to forbid propaganda literature, propaganda films like Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, and so on and so on. But as you say, meanwhile, nearly 70 years are gone by, and we are talking of different generations who firstly know what happened, what was the result of Hitler's and the Third Reich's madness, and who do everything to maintain the memory and the commemoration to all the victims who paid the price for that. So I think they are old enough, they are adults, they are grown up, and they should know what they are able to read and what not.
Following on from that point, is there not an argument that Hitler's work should be freely available? Because as anybody, as I'm sure you have, has tried to read Mein Kampf will know, yeah. It is a fantastically boring and silly book.
So is it really necessary? I mean, there are so many other boring books taking our time. I mean, I can imagine that some people are really afraid. For example, imagine a tourist from America, a former Jew who emigrated from Germany, or maybe Israeli tourist, and they come into a German bookshop and there are piles and piles of Hitler's Mein Kampf, uncommented and at a very good price. What should they think? And I can imagine, I mean, I'm just not talking for myself, but I can imagine that this image is everything but wished for by the government or the Bavarian Ministry of Finance. Anyway, I do not know how to prevent that and whether one should prevent that, because, as I said before, everybody who wants to can have it, can read in it. Whether one should really push the idea that everybody should have read this, well, that's a matter of taste, I think. I really do not recommend shit.
But to go back to the original idea of Zeitung Zeugen's proposal, which was they wanted to print it with annotations explaining it and illuminating it, the president of Germany's Central Council of Jews said that he would rather have the book published like that than available unadulterated online, which of course it is now and has been for many years.
Well, that's true. And though this happened a bit late, it is really the same intention of the Free State of Bavaria. At the moment, at the so-called Institute for Zeitgeschichte in Munich, a couple of historians is working on a commented edition of Hitler's Mein Kampf. So Patrick McGee was a bit quicker than that. I personally, I do not know why he should not do this, but yeah, I'm not the Bavarian Minister of Finance.
When that copyright deadline elapses in 2015, do you imagine there will be much interest in people republishing it? I mean, do you think there would be a market for it or not?
Well, I wonder if that will be a big business, but I'm not thinking economically. I'm not a publisher or editor. I mean, just thinking, for example, of some 100,000 teachers who teach history and other stuff in the schools, and each one buying one of Mr. McGee's newspaper or maybe later a commented copy of Mein Kampf, then of course the printing costs, you will get the printing costs back very, very soon. But generally speaking, in the idea of or in the vision of having a bestseller rediscovered from history, I really don't think that, because at present people have other problems, and in a time when neo-Nazism and anti-Semitism are riding their heads all over Europe here and there. I think not too many people will really be interested in the way how Hitler thought about that. But that's a very personal point of view, maybe because I'm working with that mad stuff every day.
Hans Christian Toybrück, thank you very much for your time this evening.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
That was Hans Christian Toybrück from the Museum of Nuremberg speaking to me earlier. It's 18:15 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time for a song. This is Laura Cantrell.
Yeah, I don't know which way I'm going, but I'll dive right in and hope I come out fine.
That was Laura Cantrell with Churches Off the Interstate and Very Much My Choice. I've gone crazy with power. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be talking to Monocle's culture editor Rob Bound about what's in his section in the current issue. You're listening to Monocle 24.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the design section, we take a closer look at charm and profile 10 companies around the world that are nailing it. We also kick back on the beach in New Zealand in Herbst Architect's latest creation.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24 and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
It's 18:20 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, Monocle's 50th edition is on the newsstands this week. Yay us. And joining me in the studio now is culture editor Robert Bound to talk about Japanese bookstores. But first, French popular music.
Hi, Andrew.
G'day. Specifically, Air, who you went to visit.
Went to see them in their studio in Paris, which is an amazing thing. It's sort of like a bit of a Bond villain underground lair. It's not actually underground, which is the only disappointing part about it. It's this beautiful thing split into three spaces, two big rooms. One is a practice room, one's a playing room. So one's for mucking about in, but mucking about, you know, with like a sort of Steinway and some amazing vintage synths that kind of most musicians would be very jealous of. I think they keep kind of not just Paris's, not just France's, but most of Europe's kind of like Moog technicians in business by occasionally kind of missing a key or something going wrong with them. So they've got this amazing place. And I went to visit them because they've just cut or they've just released their new record called La Voyage dans la Lune.
Which is, it's not the first film soundtrack they've done. They did a sort of massively well-received and successful one for Virgin Suicides, but this one is a slightly unusual project.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than working with, you know, an extant film director like Sofia Coppola for the Virgin Suicides, they've done a soundtrack to a film from 1902. Is it 1902? It's not 1912. It's 1902. A film by Georges Méliès, which was The Man in the Moon, which was this sort of iconic image of that man that people who watch Peep Show and things like that will know. This sort of man with a man's face covered in shaving cream who gets a rocket in the eye. And this is The Man in the Moon. And it was the first sort of science fiction film. It was the first, before anyone had obviously ever thought of a space mission or a moon mission. Weirdly, this film by Georges Méliès, this sort of first superstar of French cinema, prefigured it all, prefigured the Apollo landings and all these kind of things by space rocket crashing into the moon and then crashing down into the sea and being rescued by the military. It's a really weird thing watching it. And of course, it's an amazing kind of film that's been recolored in by sort of Californian kind of graphic artists and all the rest of it. But they've done this. It's very soundtracky, this soundtrack they've done. Well, it's not necessarily very albumy.
A lot of their stuff is very soundtracky, even when there isn't a film to go with it. What was it appealed to them about this project? Is it, I mean, do they have an ongoing lunar thing? I mean, of course, they released an album many years ago called Moon Safari, or is this just a coincidence?
Well, I think, no, they do. They're obsessed with the moon. They're obsessed with this idea of space, both in terms of, you know, the galaxy and the Milky Way, and in terms of kind of having this airiness around them. I've used the word air and moon there. See, that's why they live up to their name so well, Andrew.
I see what you did there.
I did it by accident.
I'm kind of surprised, I have to say, by your description of the studio and by the photos. I think I vaguely imagined that the whole thing would be silver in white and that they made their music in lab coats.
No, they're kind of very, they're proper, they're kind of prog rock fans, actually.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, I quite like that, but we'll have to agree to disagree. They're very much, as you can see, they're sort of like rugs and mahogany walls and all the rest of it. They had the studio kind of made to their standards. So
when you say prog, are we talking about the ghastly golden era of British prog? Are we talking the sort of, is it the Roger Dean posters on the wall? And
It is a bit. They sort of go from the more strung out bits of the Beatles into Genesis and things like that, I think. When I told them that my mate's dad was the keyboard player in Genesis, they wanted to know quite a lot about it.
Wow.
No, I've never heard the word wow uttered with less sincerity than that, by the way.
I mean, what I think is the real benchmark, though, if you're going to flirt with prog, have either of them ever talked about wanting to perform wearing a cape? I think that's when you've crossed the line. That's when you've gone full prog.
I think they're still into sort of like quite neat sort of winkle picker shoes, and they're quite tucked in. They're quite cool. So they remain cool. They remain French, but they do have a little bit of a soft spot for Emerson, Lake and Palmer and things like that.
Well, on the
King Crimson.
On the subject of remaining French, I did like the fact that they said in your interview that they didn't hold with these kind of insanely dedicated 19-hour days in the studio. Yeah. They always took time off for lunch and dinner.
Yeah, exactly. I know. They really are. I think they can say something quite interesting. The copies you say that sort of, you know, they'll go into the studio for sort of 5 or 6 hours and work 5 or 6 hours, because after that everything's pointless. As we all know, don't we, to our cost.
Usually, yes, you do start to experience diminishing returns dramatically at that point. Because 5 or 6 hours is regarded as a fairly sort of overextended working day in France, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like being... I mean, if you say you've
been
working
overtime,
five, exactly,
as far as the French are concerned.
People expect there to be sort of whip marks on your back if you've been in the office or the studio for more than 6 hours.
Elsewhere in the section, there's a major report on a beautiful-looking new Japanese bookstore, Tsutaya, which has just opened in Tokyo. Is this a new kind of bookshop?
It is. Well, it's a sort of new old kind of bookshop. It's kind of a bit like a library, and it's a bit like a bookshop. Tsutaya are a sort of a department store, and they've always had a great sort of media offering, books and records and magazines particularly, from all around the world, not just Japanese language. But this is something that I think their founder wanted to do to sort of satisfy his own kind of thing of wanting to browse, wanting to have vintage stuff in there. So there's I don't know how many, I think there's 5,000 different magazine titles in this one shop alone. And lots of them are kind of old issues. So if you want to go and buy issue 1 of Monocle or, you know, issue 27 of Select magazine, Andrew. Or Melody Maker.
Now you're talking.
Yeah, exactly. Then you can kind of go and get it in there. But it is this amazingly beautiful thing. And it's kind of, we were talking in the issue about charming. I think the sort of overriding theme for this issue is sort of charmingness.
And we have declared
and
Japan
this is my sort of
world's
charming
most
bit.
Charming country.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know, but this Daikanyama is a district of Japan which has got some amazing shops in it. And this sort of fits right into the Daikanyama shopping vibe, in that you don't sort of realise you're shopping. You feel perhaps like you're collecting.
It is absolutely beautiful. And looks exactly like what I wished my own lounge room did, but doesn't.
I know. Same here. I wish mine did too. No, it's super. It's genuinely, I think, beautiful. The lighting and the materials they use, as well as, you know, the best furnished rooms are the ones that are furnished with books, I think, right?
Okay, well, Robert, thank you very much for that. It's now time for another track, and having heard earlier about Air's new album, we should probably hear something from Air's new album. This is Parade.
We'll be right back.
That was Air with Parade. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's nearly 6:30 in London. Coming up in the next half an hour, we'll be hearing how to become a Brazilian telenovela star, or at least how to behave like one for the evening. We also get the latest from the Rotterdam International Film Festival, which began today. But first, here is the world news with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Andrew. The rich and powerful of the world were divided at their annual gathering in the Swiss town of Davos today over Barack Obama's threat to raise their taxes, with some saying policies that go after the wealthy will hurt growth, but others saying Obama was right to address capitalism's imbalances. Thousands of Swiss military and police have been using snow to build security barriers to prevent demonstrators from gate-crashing the World Economic Forum in Davos. US special forces have swooped into Somalia and rescued an American and a Dane after a shootout with pirates holding them hostage in a rare raid into the Horn of Africa nation to free foreign captives. Tens of thousands massed in Cairo's Tahrir Square and other Egyptian cities today, a year after an uprising erupted that toppled Hosni Mubarak, spurred on revolts across the region, and exposed rifts in the Arab world's most populous state. The UN Security Council could vote as early as next week on a Western Arab draft resolution endorsing the Arab League's call for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to transfer powers to his deputy. A government bus driver sped through the streets of the Indian city of Pune today, smashing his empty bus into dozens of vehicles, killing 9 people and injuring 27. Nordic budget carrier Norwegian Air Shuttle has placed an order for 222 narrow-body aircraft worth $21.5 billion at list prices to be split between Boeing and Airbus. The Russian Central Election Commission has approved the candidacy of Russia's third richest man, Mikhail Prokhorov, and registered him as an official candidate in the March the 4th presidential election. And Starwood Hotels and Resorts and Marriott International both said during the World Economic Forum in Davos they wanted to start running hotels in Myanmar. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, the idea of celebrating the soap opera as an expression of a culture may startle anyone who has watched one, but London's Victoria and Albert Museum begs, at least this week, to differ. This Friday, the 27th, as part of its Hot Brazil season, the V&A will host the filming of an episode of Victoria and Alberto, a soap especially created for the occasion by London-based art collective Brasiliality. Parts in the soap, or telenovela as they're known in Brazil, will be available to some audience members. And joining me now in Studio One is Brasiliality's Alicia Bastos. Good evening.
Hello, good evening.
So how will this work exactly?
Well, basically, we were approached by the Vittorio and Albert Museum with the proposal of creating something for the night or participating somehow. And they just said, well, what about a telenovela? We thought about it, but it sounds impossible. I just thought, actually, nothing is impossible. Let's make this happen. And we got our team together, and after a lot of work and about 15 people involved, we came up with the story, which is based on the original facts of taking Victoria and Albert to Brazil in the 1850s. And this is going to be an incredible night. So it will be on 3 acts. So the audience will be staring at it. So we have no actors. We have the script. We have the plan. And we have a lot of assets that will accompany the night. So we have music. We have all designed specially for this. We will be in the cafe area close to the restaurant. And the audience will come. We'll, you know, pick a character. We'll be dressed up. And we'll be really like in a studio set that we setting up inside of the museum. And from outside of the studio, people will be able to watch it through a VJ. We'll be mixing the images within the content that we prepared. So it will be a challenge, but it will be a great, great fun.
So just to recap, the plot of this soap opera will be Queen Victoria and Prince Albert traveling to Brazil in the 1850s.
Yes.
But you need to turn that into kind of a soap opera. So without giving away the ending, what kind of things happen to them?
They meet the magnanimous, which was the Brazilian emperor called Dom Pedro II. And there is a cultural relationship that happens between, you know, the royalty, the English royalty okay. that comes to Brazil and the Brazilian one.
Okay, this is obviously being part of the Hot Brazil celebration, and it's advancing the telenovela as a reflection of something unique about Brazil. Now, every country in the world has its own soap operas, or almost every country. What is different or distinctive about Brazilian soap operas?
If you imagine that we have 195 million people in Brazil and between 60 and 80 million people watch the soap opera, it's much more than just a television programme. It affects our economy. It's actually one of the biggest cultural industries thing that we export. Not only that, we export the music of it, the actors, you know, the celebrities. It's also very social effective kind of influence that it does into people. So it reduced fertility in Brazil up to 60% of certain areas.
How did that work?
Well, if you go around Brazil and if you look into the slums or the favelas, how they call it, you will see that, you know, some houses may not even have proper walls, but they will have a satellite thing, and they will have a television and they will watch the soap opera. It's incredible. It's just the way, it's just the influence, the popular influence of the soap operas.
And are we talking about one soap opera in particular, or are there several?
Well, there is the biggest Brazilian television station, Globo, which pioneered after 2P was the first one to do a telenovela. That was the pre-Globo. Globo is the actual, the biggest television station in Brazil. And they are the ones who made soap opera such a massive production. And there is, so they have a beginning, a middle and an end. So they last between about 4, 5, 6, 7 months, depending of the size of the script and the story. And it's a really big build-up. But they also have one that starts at 6 p.m., one that starts at 7 p.m., and one that starts at 8 p.m. between, you know, and there's some news in between.
But the soap operas, they're kind of contained. They're not these ones like, say, the British ones like Coronation Street or the Australian ones like Neighbours, which just go on and on and on for decades and decades and decades.
Yeah, no.
It's a one-off with a beginning, a middle and an end.
Exactly, and they massive productions and very catchy subjects. For example, they would deal with like health problems. They would do like a case of cancer. They make a massive drama out of that. Or they will make something that happens in India. They had a really amazing one about India. So they had the whole production, all the costumes, value. And this is incredible because it really does influence everything culturally in Brazil. The music, you know, the way people look, the way people cut their hair, the way they talk. It's something. It's, if you haven't watched one and you will start to, you won't be able to let it go.
So if somebody wants to appear in a Brazilian soap opera, what time should they get to the V&A on Friday?
We will start at 6:30. We will have at one. So how we divide it to make sure that we can accommodate as many people as possible. So we have 3 acts and 4 people acting on each act. So one program will include 12 people from the audience. So I would say get there as soon as possible, find us close to the restaurant and come and have some fun.
I'm very nearly curious myself, but I'm not really sure my accent's up to it. That was Alicia Bastos of Braziliality. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and this is Astrid Williamson with Superman 2. That was Astrid Williamson with Superman 2. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's coming up for 1842 in London. Stay with us. We'll shortly be talking about whether or not executives deserve their vast salaries.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, one economic indicator which has appeared serenely untroubled by the financial upheavals of the last few years has been the pay of CEOs. Indeed, as a factor of employee wages, they are spiralling out of sight, though in some countries more than others. An average Japanese CEO receives 11 times the pay of one of his workers, a British boss 22 times the money, but an American Montgomery Burns rakes in $475 for every buck banked by one of his Homer Simpsons. So, are CEOs justly rewarded titans of industry, or are they a sack of unregenerate pirates who should be first against the wall when the revolution comes? Earlier, Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove spoke to Dr. Brian Bell, research fellow at the London School of Economics. She began by asking why this disparity matters.
I think they care because of what's happened to the gap that executives are getting and how much they're getting. You know, if you look at the latest data, the CEO of a FTSE 100 company perhaps earns 100 times what the average worker earns. And that might or might not be acceptable in a period in which workers' wages are also going up, but it becomes much more politically difficult when workers' wages are stagnating, as they certainly have done since the beginning of the recession.
To be clear, these are private companies. So does the government actually intend, does the UK government actually intend to intervene and actually set a target saying, you know, this is how much you can pay your top execs?
I mean, there was discussion of that and the government have shied away from it. So some commentators have suggested that firms should be required to report what the ratio is between the pay of their chief executive and the pay of their ordinary worker, and then have some limit as to how much that multiple can be. The government have not gone down that line in the end and have simply said that's the kind of thing that firms should report on. And their idea is that transparency in and of itself will encourage more sensible behaviour from firms.
And the opposition Labour Party in the UK has said, you know, we'd like to see the ratio between the top pay and the sort of average worker of the company published too. Do you think that would make a big difference?
I think it would make almost no difference whatsoever. I mean, for two reasons. First of all, because actually we can work it out. So for most firms already, we know what the pay of the chief executive is. And from company accounts, we can work out what, we know what the wage bill of the entire firm is, and we know how many people they employ. So dividing one by the other gives you roughly the average wage of a worker. So we can sort of already do it. So I'm not sure why we think it would have a big effect if it was published in their accounts. But the second reason why I don't think it would have any effect is that no one has said why it has any meaning. So just to give you a very simple example, that ratio would actually be quite low for Goldman Sachs because everyone at Goldman Sachs by and large earns a lot. So the CEO still earns a lot, but as a ratio, not necessarily ridiculous. Whereas that ratio for Tesco's would be very high because Tesco's employs lots of part-time, fairly low-paid checkout staff and the like, and the CEO of Tesco's get paid a lot. So, but does that mean that the CEO of Tesco's is more ridiculously paid than the CEO of Goldman Sachs? I don't see why.
And to what extent do you think this is playing out in the international community? I mean, we've seen a bill in the UK, but I mean, at the same time, Mitt Romney's published his tax return and it's only 14%. Does it bother people in the US, for example?
So it does. I mean, the multiples that I talked earlier about, the multiple, you know, the average CEO of a FTSE 100 company in the UK earns about 100 times more than an average worker. In the US, the head of an S&P 500 company earns about 300 times what the average worker earns. So actually, it's even more extreme in the US. And only 2 years ago, a bill was passed in Congress that actually required this reporting of the ratio between the CEO and the worker to be in U.S. company accounts. Now, they're backtracking on that now. I mean, I think in the U.S., there's obviously historically been more of a relaxed attitude to people getting very wealthy, which perhaps is less so in the U.K. and certainly less so in continental Europe. But I think, again, it's this pressure is building in the U.S. because for the last 30 years, the median family has seen no increase in their living standard, whereas the people at the top have seen an astounding increase in their living standard. And, of course, you know, when they're getting their income now often from capital gains and therefore only paying 15% in tax, then, you know, that's where the pressure builds and where there's public outcry.
And what about Europe? I mean, do we see the same, you know, inequalities of income in somewhere like Italy or France?
No, you don't. So historically, income inequality has been much less of a problem and much lower in continental European countries than in the Anglo-Saxon countries. But even in those countries, you're beginning to see, particularly the top sort of 1%, the top 5%, you're beginning to see their incomes accelerating away. So in France, for example, we've just seen some recent data that shows that, again, the top 1% are increasing their share of the pie at the expense of the rest of the country.
And finally, I mean, we're talking about this idea of a sort of meritocracy. So you earn, you know, if you happen to be a very successful exec, you earn a huge salary. I mean, to what extent is this bill like some sort of quasi-socialist notion of sort of capping people's pay and evening things out? And is that really sort of at odds with the government?
Well, I think basically they're not doing any of that. I think what we've seen is from the announcement is that they've actually backtracked on anything that smacks of trying to control CEO pay. There's nothing in the legislation, as far as I can see, that directly attempts to control CEO pay. It's all on the hope that giving shareholders more votes, making things more transparent, will somehow magically reduce CEO pay. And I know of no evidence to show that historically or across countries that that's true. So I think they've just decided that they don't want to regulate CEO pay in any significant way. So I think actually they're being fairly consistent with how you would expect a Conservative-led government to behave.
But I mean, it's just interesting that people do care that other people are rich. I mean, does it make any difference to them?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we compare ourselves with two groups of people. We compare ourselves with sort of our co-workers and or people who we think are about the same level as us, and we worry about whether our pay is like theirs. And then I think we just look at the people who are very, very well off, and we just, you know, we grumble about it because we think it's very unfair. But I don't think, what's interesting is that, I think this is probably true in most countries, it's funny who we think it's bad to get paid a lot and who it's good to get paid a lot. So my favourite example is that, you know, Wayne Rooney earns much more than a CEO of a FTSE 100 company. But no one really goes out after Wayne Rooney and says, it's outrageous that you earn so much money. And it's not clear to me, you know, from a society's point of view, you could argue it's much more important that we appoint the right person to head a big FTSE 100 company than to make sure Wayne Rooney gets a lot of money, because, you know, the overall wealth that the CEO can produce if he does a good job is much more than Wayne Rooney will ever produce.
That was Dr. Brian Bell from the London School of Economics speaking to Monocle's Sophie Grove. It's 10 minutes to 7. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The 41st annual Rotterdam International Film Festival began today. Joining me now from Rotterdam is Julia von Murek, advisor to the festival's Film Fund. Good evening.
Good evening.
What are you most looking forward to at the festival this year?
Well, as always, there's a lot of art at the Film Festival in Rotterdam. And, well, what am I looking forward to most? I think it's the piece of Germaine Kruijp. It's called Eye Trap. and she made a soundtrack written especially for one of the most spectacular views from Rotterdam. It's the panorama from the cruise terminal on the Maas River. And she invited the Metropole Orchestra, it's a very famous orchestra in Holland, to write a piece of music for it. So everybody will be sitting in this big hall watching the sunset over the Maas, and then this music will sound.
So she's kind of created a soundtrack for a vast natural outdoor production. Among the films that are premiering at Rotterdam this year, are you noticing any particular themes among them?
A lot of sex. Yes, and of course the...
Is that unusual?
Well, it's more than normal, I think, because we have this, you've probably heard about it, this Steve McQueen film, Shame.
Yeah.
It's about a yuppie, a New York yuppie, being a sex addict. And there's been a lot talking about it, about the way he visualized it and how much it reminds to American Psycho. But there's also this program that's all about the Brazilian porn industry and how creative and outstanding it was in the 70s and 80s.
What were the Brazilians, I shudder to ask, but what were the Brazilians doing in the 70s and 80s that nobody else was doing?
Well, I don't know, making films. but also there is this program, and it's called Signal, and it is showing movies outside of the projection room. So it says the canvas, the city is a canvas for performances, and there's a lot of interesting stuff happening over there also.
I wanted to ask particularly about, there's three Film Fund films in the Tiger Awards competition for short films. I was especially interested in Hala El-Koussi's In Search of a City, which was shot both before and after the revolution. Is that right?
I think it was shot before the revolution, but she edited after the revolution.
And do you know how the fact of the revolution changed her film?
I haven't spoken to her about it, but... undoubtedly, it is of major influence because I've been to Egypt. I lived there for a half a year, and it was before the revolution. And what I gather from people who live there now, it changed totally. The whole atmosphere changed. So her film must have changed tremendously because the film is about Cairo. It's it's kind of a love story singing to the city. It's a kind of a declaration of love to the city of Cairo. So it must have changed tremendously.
Julia von Murek from the Rotterdam International Film Festival, thank you very much for joining us this evening. And that's all for this Wednesday's edition of Midori House on Monocle 24. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. Thank you, gentlemen. In 3 hours, it is time for the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. And in just a few minutes, it's a premiere of the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's weekly programme on business. The headlines will be coming up and will play out on a song. This is Simeon Mobile Disco with Audacity of Huge.